This is Jillian, and I'm here to tell you about my new sponsor, Lifeway Kefir. You may have heard me talking about them in my last brief episode, or even talking about them in our Facebook group. And the reason why I'm talking them up so much is not only because they agreed to sponsor me when I asked them to, but because they are truly awesome, and I've been a fan of them for quite some time now. Lifeway Kefir is a creamy and delicious cultured dairy drink that's even healthier and more convenient than yogurt. An 8-ounce serving of Lifeway Kefir has 11 grams of all-natural protein, 12 different probiotics, 30% of your daily calcium requirement, and it's 99% lactose-free. And they are truly delicious. It's a perfect snack for rushed mornings or in between your trial watching breaks. Look for Lifeway Kefir in the dairy case at your local favorite store and visit lifewaykefir.com for coupons and recipes. That's Lifeway, K-E-F-I-R.com. Hello and welcome to episode 11 of the Court Junkie podcast. I cannot believe I'm on episode 11 already. I guess time really does fly when you're having fun and doing what you love. And I couldn't do this without you guys. Thank you to all of you for your support. And just a couple reminders before we start the show. Please remember to subscribe if you like it, and please leave me a review on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever it is that you're listening from. And if you want to discuss the case, as well as any other case, please consider joining our Court Junkie discussion group on Facebook. Right now, we're talking about everything from the Dahlia Dipolito trial to our favorite true crime documentaries. And to become a supporter of this podcast and enjoy these episodes without hearing all those ads, go to patreon.com/courtjunkie and you can donate as little as a dollar a month to this podcast, and then you'll get access to these episodes without the ads. That's patreon.com/courtjunkie. And I'll thank some more of my supporters at the end of this episode. But now, on to today's case. If there's one thing I've learned from following these cases, it's that not all of them are black and white, and not all of them are as they appear. The case we're going to talk about today at first seems like an open and shut case, but then you hear about the reasoning behind it, and it makes you think, and it begs some serious questions about what's fair when there's a gray area. This case takes place in August 2012, and it begins with a man going to visit his wife in the hospital. It was a Saturday, August 4th, 2012. 66-year-old John Wise was in a cab, in a hurry to get from his home in Massillon, Ohio, to Akron General Medical Center, about 30 miles away. He was going to see Barbara, his wife of 45 years, who had been admitted into the hospital the week prior after suffering a series of brain aneurysms that had left her unable to speak. This last week had been horrible. He had found his wife lying on the bathroom floor of their home, and then she had to be airlifted to the hospital. When John arrived, he calmly entered through the main hospital entrance, as he had done every day since Barbara had been admitted. The hospital staff had grown accustomed to seeing him there, the faithful husband visiting his ailing wife. And on this day, he went up to the third floor neurointensive care unit to room 3201, where his wife lay in her hospital bed. It was about 8:45 p.m. He greeted her by kissing her softly on the cheek, and then he pulled out a 9mm pistol, held it up to her left temple, and pulled the trigger. The 911 calls came pouring in from doctors, nurses, visitors, and patients about an active shooter in the hospital. One nurse called while hiding in a room nearby. She tells the 911 operator that at first the staff had thought it was an oxygen tank going off before realizing that it was a gunshot.
Gunshot is up here on the third floor. Yes. They just told us to close the door.
Two security officers ran into Barbara's hospital room, ordered John to drop the gun, and then subdued him until police arrived. John was booked into the Summit County Jail and charged with attempted aggravated murder. His wife was in critical condition and was fading fast. Barbara didn't make it past the next morning. At 10:20 a.m., she died from her injuries. John appeared in court on that following Tuesday morning, and because the charges were still listed as attempted murder pending Barbara's autopsy, John appeared confused, and he asked the judge whether his wife was indeed dead. It seemed like he wanted to make sure that she was. The following day, John again appeared in court, this time via video conference from jail. Following Barbara's autopsy, which showed that she had died from a gunshot wound to the head, the charges had been upgraded to aggravated murder. John also now had an attorney by his side, a man named Paul Adamson, who surprised the court when he told them that John hadn't committed cold-blooded murder, that he had killed Barbara because he loved her. Adamson said, 45 years of marriage, blessed to be deeply in love with his wife throughout those 45 years, and I am absolutely confident that everything that he's ever done for his wife has been done out of deep love, including the events that just recently transpired. Adamson said that John was a good man and that there had never been any hints of any sort of domestic violence. He said that the reason for the killing was that John and Barbara had both decided that they didn't want to become disabled in a nursing home. In other words, he says that John killed her to end her suffering. John's bond was set at $1 million. As you can imagine, the local media had a field day with this case, and the small Akron community, especially those who knew John and Barbara Wise, were in disbelief. They spoke with reporters and said that there was no way John would have ever murdered his wife in cold blood. There had to be more to the story, and it seemed that there was. As reporters started poking around about exactly what had happened, they reported that a spokesperson at the Akron General Hospital confirmed that Barbara Wise had been a critically ill patient. She had been admitted on July 28, 2012, after collapsing at the home she shared with John. John had apparently found her lying on the bathroom floor, vomiting and choking. She had suffered a triple aneurysm. The Independent, a local newspaper, wrote about the case and then asked their readers, was it mercy or murder? John and Barbara met when John was 21 and Barbara was 20. They met in the 1960s at a hamburger joint in Massillon, Ohio. And according to friends and family, they lived quiet, private lives. They had a son named Mark, who was 44 years old at the time of his mother's death, and the family lived in a red brick bungalow. Their neighbors said that they would often see the couple gardening together outside, and John would reportedly regularly meet with friends at a local restaurant for morning coffee. John had worked as a steel worker for 35 years before his own illnesses forced him into retirement in the early 2000s. Barbara's sister was interviewed by a local newspaper, and she said that John and Barbara were friendly, but that they liked to keep to themselves. She said John was Barbara's first serious boyfriend, and that she had never heard of them argue. She told reporters that they had been in love. She recalled that Barbara would say something funny, and John would affectionately say, "Oh, Barbie." John had no criminal history and no record of any violent tendencies. On August 24th, John officially entered a plea of not guilty. The judge reduced his bail amount from $1 million to $500,000, and John was let out of jail to await his trial while on house arrest. Just prior to trial, John's attorney, Paul Adamson, gave the media a preview about what their defense was going to look like. Adamson again reiterated that it was a mercy killing, but he said that since mercy isn't a legal defense in Ohio, they would be putting forward an insanity defense instead, and they were going to base it on severe depression. He told reporters that their burden would be to establish that John had been suffering from a mental illness at the time of the killing, and that he didn't understand that what he was doing was wrong. John's trial started in November 2013 in the Summit County Court of Common Pleas. In addition to the counts of aggravated murder, he also faced single counts of murder and felonious assault with gun specifications attached to all three of those charges. He was facing a possible life in prison sentence if convicted. John's trial would not only reveal what he was thinking when he shot and killed his wife, but another twist would be revealed that would add yet another complicated layer to this case. In their opening statements, prosecutors said that John had acted intentionally and that he should be held responsible. John's attorney, Paul Adamson, told the jury that John did shoot his wife, but that he only did it in an act of mercy. He said that John and Barbara had made a pact to not let one another endure prolonged suffering if one of them ever became seriously ill. Then Adamson outlined what had happened for the jury. He said that on the night of August 4th, 2012, John was visiting Barbara at the hospital with their son when he saw a tear running down her cheek, and he snapped. When John got home from that visit, he grabbed his 9mm pistol and returned to the hospital to shoot his wife. Sergeant Dave Garrow testified for the prosecution and said that a handwritten note had been found in Barbara's hospital room on the day of the shooting. The note contained an apology for any trauma and inconvenience, and also said that the shooting was done with love, for good and honorable reasons. The note went on to say that the couple had agreed to not let each other live as veggies with no quality of life. The jury also heard John's videotaped interview with Sergeant Garrow just hours after the shooting. In the video, John tells the sergeant that he had intended to shoot his wife 3 or 4 times and then shoot and kill himself, but he said that his gun jammed after that first shot. Garrow asked John what his plan would be if Barbara somehow survived the shooting, because remember, she was in critical condition at that time. John told him, "I couldn't take care of her." He said he didn't want to see her laying there like a vegetable. Towards the end of the interview, Sergeant Garrow again asked John what his concerns would be if his wife survived, to which John replied, "I hope she doesn't survive so I don't have to take care of her, or she can't take care of herself." John said, "I don't care much what happens to me. I just didn't want to see her suffering." One of Barbara's nurses in the neurological unit also testified. She said that she never told John that Barbara's condition was terminal and that she recalled talking to him about long-term care possibilities. She said she remembered telling him that those types of injuries can take up to a year to recover from. She said John always appeared to be in his right mind during their discussions. Dr. Michael Passero Jr., a pulmonary care physician at the hospital, testified that he had run into Barbara's room shortly after hearing the gunshot. He said he had heard a popping sound and that he and the nurses were trying to figure out what it was. He went into Barbara's room and he saw John sitting at Barbara's bedside, and he then noticed John's gun in his hand. He said that John said to him, "Please tell me that she's dead." Dr. Passero said that he looked at Barbara and he told John, "I'm sorry, she's not dead." He said he told John that he could help save Barbara if John would put down the gun. But instead of releasing the gun, John was struggling to get it to work. The gun had jammed. Dr. Passero said that Barbara let out a loud gasping breath and John said, "Oh God, she's still alive. How can she still be alive?" while frantically trying to unjam the gun. Two hospital security guards then came in and tackled him. Dr. Passero said that he and other staff members then began tending to Barbara, but it would be too late. Then Dr. Passero told the jury that although Barbara's condition prior to the shooting wasn't good, she was stable and responding to medication. And that testimony was backed up by a man named Dr. George Markarian, who was the neurosurgeon who treated Barbara for the aneurysms immediately after she had been airlifted to the hospital on July 28th. Dr. Markarian told the jury that there was no way her condition warranted any end-of-life discussions. He said that one of the three aneurysms had been leaking blood when she had first arrived at the hospital, but that he had been able to seal it during a surgical procedure known as coiling. He said that Barbara could have survived. Before we get into the defense's case, I want to interject with another word about our sponsor, Lifeway Kefir. I already told you how nutritious they are, that they contain all natural protein, 12 different probiotics and calcium, and I already told you that they're 99% lactose free, which is a huge plus in my opinion. But they're also really, really tasty. They come in delicious flavors like blueberry, strawberry, Madagascar vanilla, and honey fig. The blueberry ones are my favorite. So look for Lifeway Kefir in the dairy case at your favorite local store and visit lifewaykefir.com for coupons. That's Lifeway, K-E-F-I-R.com. Now back to the episode. When it was time for the defense to present their case, they called Dr. Mark Janison to the stand. Dr. Janison testified that John had showed signs of depression, PTSD, and a preoccupation with his own illnesses in a recent evaluation. Dr. Janison said that he met with John the month prior to trial and that he concluded that John was suffering from severe depression and that at the time of the incident, he wasn't aware that what he was doing was wrong. Dr. Janison also testified that John had injected himself with an overdose of insulin before going to the hospital that night, which Dr. Janison said would have caused extreme confusion. The defense also had character witnesses, not only for John himself, but for John and Barbara's relationship. John and Barbara's son Mark testified that his parents had always had a good relationship and that he had been the one to give his father a gun to use for protection. One of John's friends, Terry Henderson, also took the stand to say that John had seemed lost after his wife had been hospitalized. But the defense's main witness was John himself. As I said before, John had his own illnesses that he was dealing with, which included diabetes. So when John took the stand, he was noticeably in a wheelchair, and he often wiped his eyes with tissues as he spoke. John told the jury that he had decided to shoot Barbara after she appeared to be in pain during a visit earlier that day. He said, "She opened her eyes and looked at me like she was in pain, and a tear rolled down her cheek. I decided then what I was going to do." He said that he had grown concerned that Barbara's condition was worsening and that medical staff had told him that it was hour to hour. He said that he and his wife had a pact to never let each other live in a comatose state. He recalled for the jury the moment he shot her. He said, "My recollection is that I walked in there, and within 2 minutes, I kissed her on the cheek and shot her." On cross-examination, the prosecutor asked how John felt about the testimony by the doctors that Barbara may have recovered. John replied, "About as bad as I can. She would still be with me." In his closing argument, Summit County Assistant Prosecutor Brian Laprinzi said, "Poor judgment based upon emotion does not equal insanity." That statement was also displayed on the courtroom monitor on the big screen. Laprinzi said that the defense had failed to prove insanity and that they had to show, by a preponderance of the evidence, that John had a severe mental disease or defect at the time of the shooting and that he didn't know the wrongfulness of his actions. And instead, Laprinzi said that John and his defense team had tried to show how sad and pitiful the situation was. but that it wasn't a pity case. He said that there was clear evidence that John had acted with prior calculation and design, and that he had purposely killed his wife, and he should be convicted of aggravated murder. He said, "The case comes down to one thing. It's uncontested. This defendant went home, got his gun, knew what he was going to do, got in the cab, hid the gun in his bag, came back, went into the hospital, pulled out the gun, and shot his wife. Uncontroverted. We met every single element of aggravated murder." John's attorney, Adamson, stood right next to John as he gave his closing argument, which the prosecution objected to. Adamson said over the objection, "I am very proud to be standing next to John Wise." Adamson went on to call John an honorable man, a good and decent person. 35 years in the shop, 45 years married, raised a family, supported them. He's a good and honorable man, and I think that's where this all starts. Adamson said that John killed his wife out of love and that he fully believed that he was doing the right thing, not the wrong thing. Adamson took out the verdict forms and held them up in front of the jury, saying, "One of the choices in each of these forms is not guilty by reason of insanity. You write that on each one of these four verdict forms and you'll sleep well tonight. And it's the right verdict." The jury took little more than 3 hours to reach their verdict, and it was clearly an emotional one for them, as several jurors openly cried as the verdicts were read. Before the judge, Judge Mary Margaret Rollins, announced the verdict, John reached across the defense table and shook Prosecutor LaPrinzi's hand. He said, "No hard feelings, although I disagree with you 100%. I don't know how this is going to turn out, sir, but I'm telling you the truth. I'm not lying." He then stared straight ahead as the judge read the verdict forms. Guilty of aggravated murder, murder, and felonious assault. John was immediately taken into custody. John was due to be sentenced later that month, and the community couldn't help but speculate as to what John's sentence would be. Under Ohio law, the judge would be expected to impose a mandatory sentence of life in prison on the most serious charge. Prosecutor LaPrinzi spoke to reporters and said that John had declined an offer of a reduced charge of manslaughter, which would have carried a maximum 14-year sentence. And now he would have to serve a minimum of 23 years. But then something happened that isn't very common, at least not in cases that I've followed. Surprisingly, before the sentencing hearing, prosecutors petitioned the court and recommended a lighter punishment for John due to what they called the unique circumstances of the case. Summit County Prosecutor Sherry Bevan Walsh said that John's actions were illegal and dangerous, but that the case warranted sentencing leniency. She recommended that he be sentenced on a lesser crime and get a 6-year prison term. She said, "In light of the unique facts of this case, a shorter prison sentence is just." In December 2013, John returned to court to hear his sentence. Prosecutor LaPrinzi told the judge, "This is not normal. It is extremely unusual and probably most likely will never happen again in my career." But LaPrinzi said that although John believed that his wife would never recover, doctors believed that there was a good chance that she would. Although his motive may have been pure, he was wrong, LaPrinzi said, and he asked the judge to sentence him to 6 years in prison, calling it an extraordinary act of clemency, mercy. John also spoke to the court.
"I would just like to apologize to my family and my friends, and especially my son. And I want to also thank you, the court and the prosecutors, for I couldn't ask for anything more. Thank you very much."
Before the judge sentenced him, she reminded him that he had put other people's lives in danger that day when he brought a loaded gun into the hospital.
Mr. Wise, from the time this case was assigned to me, Mr. Adamson can confirm this, I have been unable to lose sight of the fact that your actions in taking that gun into Akron General Medical Center were unacceptably dangerous on so many levels. You exposed so many innocent people to an enormous risk by taking a loaded gun into a hospital and then firing it. There are so many ways that this outcome could have been much worse than it even is, and the tragedy so much greater.
I understand.
However, I will agree to follow the recommendation of the state in this case, and I will sentence you to 3 years in prison on count three, felonious assault. I will sentence you also to the three-year mandatory sentence on the gun specification that was attached to that charge.
In total, Judge Rowland sentenced John to 6 years in prison, 3 years on the felonious assault charge, and although he was guilty of aggravated murder and murder, she decided to pass on sentencing for those charges. He received the other 3 years for the gun specifications. One of the jurors who had convicted John was there at his sentencing. In January 2014, John's attorneys officially asked the governor of Ohio for clemency. Not to erase the convictions, they said, but to free him from prison and allow him to live out the rest of his life from home. John had a number of physical ailments himself, including chronic heart disease and diabetes. In a sworn statement, John wrote, "I committed a horrible act while in a depressed and desperate mental state. I am truly sorry for what I did. Although I had nothing but good intentions, that is no excuse." But John would never make it to his clemency hearing. On July 14th, 2014, John passed away while in prison. His attorney said in a statement, "The cause of death was indicated as cardiac arrest. We prefer to believe that John died of a broken heart." John's attorney said something to reporters after his sentencing that I thought was interesting. He said that he believed that new legislation is needed for these types of cases. He said, "There's nothing in the statute to address this type of a case. Nowhere does this statute permit us to take a look inside and see what the intent was, what the motive was." Which begs the question, is he right? Do we need some type of legislation for mercy killing cases where the motives are taken into consideration? And should John's case even really be considered a mercy killing? Because although that's what he believed it was, doctors had testified that Barbara may have actually recovered from her aneurysms. Let me know what you think. You can find me on Twitter at CourtJunkiePod. You can email me at podcast@courtjunkie.com. Or you can join the Court Junkie discussion group on Facebook, because we'll definitely be talking about this in there. A special thank you to Lifeway Kiefer. And a special thank you to all of you for listening, and to my Patreon subscribers. This episode, I want to especially thank Heather, Dan, Natty, Lisa, and Lori. Thank you so much for your support. Thanks again, and until next time.